The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, things happen when people start talking. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Bill Manny.
Welcome to the City Club of Boise. I'm your moderator, Bill Manny. I'm past president of City Club and an editor and a columnist at the Idaho Statesman. I'd like to welcome the more than 200 people who are with us today, as well as the radio audience listening on Boise State Public Radio News. City Club's media partners are Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, and Pepper Shock. Our forum series sponsor is Micron. And we also have four students with us today from Boise High School, five students from Renaissance High School, and several students from University of Idaho. So let's thank our sponsors and welcome our students. I would also like to thank Kitten Bird, who is sitting at our head table from the University of Idaho. Kitten is responsible for getting Adam Goldman here today. Adam will be speaking at the University of Idaho's, let me get this right, Oppenheimer Ethics Symposium in Moscow, and they'll leave later today, but it's through their good efforts that we're able to enjoy Adam here in Boise. Now, when I first talked to Kenton about bringing Adam to speak to City Club, I started watching the New York Times for Adam's byline. I was worried, as you are when you present a program like this, that our speaker would have something interesting to share. And so I saw immediately that Adam was reporting about the CIA agent who had been arrested and for revealing the identities of American spies. So I thought, okay, we're going to have something interesting to talk about. That's a big story, and I'm not going to have to worry. Then I saw the back and forth over the House Intelligence Committee memos. We had the Republican memo, we had the Democratic memo, and we had the request for the president to declassify it so it could be released. And then we had the unprecedented action of the FBI director begging the administration to keep it classified. I thought, well, that's one of the biggest stories in the country, and we can ask Adam about that. So we're going to have lots to talk about. And then I saw President Trump tweeting about Jeff Sessions, and there's this really interesting dynamic between the Attorney General and the President, and I thought, well, we can ask Adam about that. I'm going to relax because there's lots for us to talk about with Adam. And then the President took after the Deputy Director of the FBI, who wanted to retire, but he wouldn't let him retire, so they fired him just hours before he retired, and then tweeted out gleefully about how much fun it was to fire the guy. Now, Adam has also been reporting on the shootings in Florida and the FBI, what FBI knew and didn't know about the suspect. He's helped report on the shootings in Las Vegas. And just recently, he reported on the new nominee for the CIA director and her experience about waterboarding. So now I'm starting to wonder, how in the world are we going to cover all of this with Adam today? I mean, I'm exhausted just from reading what he writes about. And I can't imagine what it's like in the New York Times Washington Bureau these days and how they get it all done. So anyway, I'm happy to see him here. He's looking relatively refreshed and energetic. And so I think he's going to do a really good job. So before we get to asking him those questions, let me give you the short version of his bio. Before joining the New York Times, Adam worked for the Washington Post, where he reported on terrorism. He got a start in journalism at newspapers in Virginia and Alabama. He covered gambling in Las Vegas for the Associated Press. And then he went to work for the Associated Press's investigative team. And in 2012, they won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting about the New York City police program spying on Muslims. That led to his book with his co-authors, Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America. So without further ado, let's welcome to the podium Adam Goldman.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here in Idaho. It's my first time, and I woke up this morning to a very beautiful state. And good coffee, by the way. I want to take this opportunity to talk about fake news, but first I want to set the record straight on something. You know, the president has this unusual relationship with the New York Times. He invites our reporters in to talk to him, right? And yet he calls us the failing New York Times. So I just want to set the record straight about that. The New York Times is not failing. Our digital subscriptions are up past 2.5 million. The paper is on incredibly solid footing. And as Recode magazine said in February after our earning results came out, people like paying for news, especially when it is in the New York Times. So let's talk about fake news. The White House has made a big deal of fake news. They've made it into a kind of joke. When people in Washington say fake news now, what they really mean is a story they don't like. Let me give you one example of this so-called fake news. NBC reported several weeks ago that President Trump was preparing to replace his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. After NBC News reported that story, the president, through his spokesman, said that was fake news. Does everybody remember that? And then the White House press secretary said in a tweet that she, quote, just spoke to POTUS and General H.R. McMaster. Contrary to reports, they have a good working relationship, and there are no changes at the National Security Council. But at the end of last week, what happened, folks? Does anybody remember what happened? The president replaced McMaster with John Bolton, so the stories weren't fake at all. They were just things the White House didn't want out. Trump's not the first politician to feel this way about the media that covers him aggressively. Thomas Jefferson, a founding father and our country's third president, once said, "As for what is not true, you will always find an abundance in the newspapers." That was Thomas Jefferson. But Mr. Trump has weaponized the phrase fake news. At first, I was deeply concerned that it would have a corrosive effect on the truth. I looked outside Washington and saw other politicians trying to blast the media using this phrase. But I've begun to realize, and I think most people are smart enough to understand, that it's just a gimmick. It's just a way to dodge the facts. And ultimately, it will lose its power and become an empty phrase, a sad cliche. But there is actual fake news. And it's not what you see in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Associated Press, all the places where I've cut my teeth as a journalist. I'm talking about news that's literally made up. It's in your Facebook timeline. It's in your Twitter feed. We now know it gets pushed by Russian bots and Russian content mills. We know these things because the real media have reported them. We know other things, too. It was the Washington Post that first reported that Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the president's then national security advisor, had lied to the vice president about a conversation he had with the Russian ambassador in late 2016, before Trump took office. Flynn said it was a friendly call, but in fact, they discussed sanctions. Mr. Flynn would ultimately plead guilty to lying to the FBI about that same conversation he had with the Russian ambassador in 2017, less than a year after it took place. Trump says Flynn was treated badly, that this was just a witch hunt. The facts demonstrate otherwise, the facts. Thanks to New York Times, you know that Don Jr., Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chairman, and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, took a meeting with Russians based on the hope of getting dirt about Hillary Clinton. You know that because of the New York Times. We know other facts, too. We know that a foreign advisor named George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contact with a Russian. We know that the government was secretly monitoring Carter Page, another Trump foreign advisor, because they believe he was acting on behalf of a foreign government, Russia. We know a lot more, and so does the public now. None of this is fake news. It is very serious news, in fact. It's been an extraordinary time to cover this very real story. I've never been prouder of my former colleagues, now competitors, at the Washington Post, where I worked before joining the Times, as well as reporters at CNN and other television networks scrapping to pry secrets from the government. The pace has been unrelenting. I have a lot of gray hair now. And has brought the best out of the best reporters in this country. And I've never been prouder to be a journalist. But the media has made its fair share of mistakes. There have been a number of instances where the media could have done better. Reporters aren't perfect, and I'm not here to tell you we are. People often ask me what it's been like reporting on Russia. It's the hardest reporting I've ever done in my life. We're dealing with the world of counterintelligence, where facts are elusive and sometimes unattainable, even as FBI agents and CIA officers trying to unearth them or make sense of what they are seeing and hearing. But editors, our bosses, and our readers, the public, want and deserve to know the truth. This period has been marked by thunderous scoops by the Washington Post and the New York Times as we battled it out every day. I think everybody remembers. It was just one after another. It never seemed like it would stop. In the movies, the phone rings and a source calls with a hot tip. But that's rarely the way it works. That's rarely how we get these scoops. Sources are afraid to email and call because of government surveillance. Tracking our emails, tracking our phones, the ability to geolocate us. The way it really works is an occasional face-to-face meeting begets a tip, and then we work feverishly to figure out if it's true. More often than not, we find out that it's not true, that people are out there spreading what are basically rumors about people they don't like. And we're talking about people who are on Trump's team, stabbing one another in the back in the most treacherous way I've ever seen as a reporter in Washington. But other times we figure it out painstakingly that something is true, a process that can involve many editors and many reporters, all of them working to get the story right and pushing back on assumptions and looking for pitfalls and landmines to get the story right, to get the facts right. So what's most alarmed me about the last year and a half? The willingness on the part of the government to call white black and vice versa. The First Amendment lets us publish almost anything we want, especially about public figures like the president or Mike Flynn or anyone else's name who you recognize. But the modern press depends on these government officials playing their part in telling the truth, or at least owning up to it. Instead, we have an administration whose communications director, Hope Hicks, recently acknowledged to congressional investigators that she told white lies for the president. We were once told by another top official in the White House there's something called alternative facts. That should scare the hell out of everybody in this room. When reporters deal with powerful institutions, and in particular the White House, there is a balance of power. That balance of power rests on this notion. When a reporter comes to the government with a story, the government respond on the level. Yes, we expect spinning, of course, or shaping, as public relations pros like to say. We know this game. The Obama administration was extraordinarily skilled at convincing the Times, the Washington Post, and other news organizations to sit on news out of concern for national security. But if we had a story dead to rights, they'd admit it, or at least decline to comment. When I worked at the Washington Post, I learned in 2014 that American commandos had captured a man accused of attacking the U.S. diplomatic facility in Benghazi in 2012 that led to the death of four people, including the U.S. ambassador. When I went to the FBI for comment, they said they needed to have a meeting. And in that meeting, they asked me to hold the story. And I said, why? They said, because the informant who provided us information that led to the capture of this man, Abu Qatala, was not safely out of the country. And we need you to hold this story. I held the story because I trusted the people I was dealing with that day. But how did I know they were telling the truth? That's a good question. I didn't, but they had a track record of being honest. Earlier this year, I covered the trial of Abu Qatala, who was convicted of attacking that same facility in 2012, the only person to date to be held responsible. During the trial, guess who testified? The informant. And what did the informant say? The informant detailed at great length the efforts it took to get him out of the country. And at that moment, I knew the FBI story lined up with the one they had told me. They were being honest. The truth matters. Outright lying and repeated outright lying destroys the relationship between press and the government. I'll give you a stark example. When the Washington Post confronted Michael Flynn about his call with the Russian ambassador, he lied. Twice, in fact. Think about it. His credibility and the credibility of the White House were on the line, but he decided to tell a lie. One that could be disproved in this case because the FBI was listening to the Russian ambassador. Legally, I might add. But he decided to tell a lie. The reporters went back to their sources and double-checked everything. And they knew they were right. How did I know this? Because many of my friends worked on this story at the Washington Post. They confronted Flynn again the next day. Flynn, through his spokesman, backed away from the denial. Quote, the spokesman said Flynn indicated that while he had no recollection of discussing sanctions, he couldn't be certain that the topic never came up. That was another lie. And the Washington Post published the truth, and Flynn lost his job and his reputation. Now he's cooperating with the special counsel, Robert Mueller, in the investigation into whether Trump tried to obstruct justice or whether any Trump associates were working with Russia. The problem is this. When we go to this administration, they aren't straight about things that are true. And when the people in government no longer tell you when you're right, then there's no reason to trust them when they say you're wrong. That is the balance of power. The government's ability to call out a genuine mistake is lost. And that ultimately means there will be more fake news, which is a loss not just for the government and the press, but more importantly, for the public at large. So what can you do? Embrace the First Amendment. It's as good as the other amendments. Get it? I swear. And it's also number one. Get a subscription to your local newspaper, which is probably struggling to survive. Support local journalism, where reporters will hold your politicians and police chiefs, and yes, business leaders and university executives accountable when they mess up. It's also where those same reporters will get the tools they need to hold the White House, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon, Amazon, or Facebook. Yes, Facebook. Accountable a few years down the line. Journalism isn't cheap. It takes time, money, resources, dedication. If you want a vigorous free press as envisioned by our founding fathers as a robust check on government, and we should all be distrustful of government, then pay for it. Because as Thomas Jefferson wrote to a friend in 1787, were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter.
You said a couple provocative, several provocative things, Adam.
Well, you paid me to come out here, didn't you?
I think our good friends at the University of Idaho did. We want to thank them again. Government surveillance of reporters, geolocating. You are being followed or surveilled by the government as you do your job?
We know that when we report on information that's highly classified, that the government will come after our phone records and emails. In 2012, I reported on a bomb plot in Yemen. It had to do with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They wanted to blow up an airliner. And so we found out about this plot, and we eventually wrote about it. About a year later, I'm sitting at my desk, and I get an email. It's from an assistant United States attorney, a federal prosecutor in D.C. And I looked at it, and there was an attachment. I thought it was spam. I turned to my colleague, Matt Puzo. I said, Matt, I'm going to forward you something. Do you think this is spam? And Matt said, no, that's a secret grand jury subpoena for our phone records. The government had gone to a grand jury, lawfully obtained a subpoena to collect our phone records for 90 days. Myself, the four reporters who worked on the story, and the editors as well for more than 20 phone lines. That's the power of the government. And we know they have the ability to do that now, and it's almost inescapable for us to do our jobs without them leaving some digital footprint. And by the way, this administration under Jeff Sessions has made it abundantly clear they are going to go after our sources. They held a news conference. They said there are 27 leak investigations. Under Obama, there were three, even though Obama was the one who, his Justice Department subpoenaed my phone records. But, you know, these are perilous times for reporters trying to do this kind of reporting.
So we have several questions about leaking versus whistleblowing.
Yeah.
And when is it appropriate to rely on leaks or whistleblowers? And clearly leaks and unidentified sources are critical to reporting. But you also talked about individual members of the administration using leaks to try to get at their competitors. So when is a leak whistleblowing, and when is it just self-interested?
I think a lot of the information that's come out of this White House over the last year have been, I haven't been directly involved in covering the White House, but from afar, it seems like there are different parties, different rivalries or factions within the White House, right? Everyone's trying to get a leg up with the president, and it's been damaging to the administration and damaging to individuals. When I deal with people, these are generally people I've known for a long time, and I trust them, right? Whether Republican or Democrat, it is not of interest to me. My only interest is that these people are honest and they have a track record of telling me the truth. And generally, if they come to me and they want to share something, they're telling it to me because they're concerned, right? They're concerned there might have been possibly a wrongdoing, or they feel, even independently and outside of the system, that the public should be aware of this information. And I think that's what you saw in that first 6 months of the Trump administration. There were generally people who were alarmed by what was happening and wanted the press to know about it.
So you did talk about you get information that is often not true.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that maybe a lay audience doesn't appreciate. They think you get a leak, you get a report, and you report it. How often do you get useful data versus unuseful data? Is it 1-to-1? Is it 10?
No, I think most of the time the first story we get is wrong. Almost always it's wrong. It's funny, I sort of label people, I have sources, I've sort of laid them like 50%, like they're right half the time, you know. So somebody comes with a good story and maybe their stock goes up, right? It's right. But it takes a long time to ferret these facts out and get these stories right. I mean, you know, we just broke a story today. I know that we've been working on it for a long time. We wrote a story about the story you mentioned. You know, we wrote a story about how the CIA's informants in China had been wiped out. And we did that while reporting on everything else. But it took us 4 months to be able to report and print that story. And most of these stories where you're dealing in the intelligence world or with the FBI are incredibly difficult. And, you know, and the problem is, A, you know, generally we rely on memories, right? Memories are faulty. We all know that. People don't, you know, they might intentionally get something wrong. You know, the world of Edward Snowden's, I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, people just don't walk into the New York Times with all the government secrets, right? You know, most of the time it's just an individual who wants to share something, and we've got to vet that information and get to a point where we're comfortable publishing.
So one of our questioners asked how the the non-disclosure agreements that are becoming, at least we're now learning about them. How is that affecting your sourcing and your reporting?
I haven't. Generally the people I talk to are in the intelligence community, so they're not supposed to be talking to me anyway. in the White House, the Trump making these people sign these non-disclosure agreements, it's my understanding of it, they're non-binding. So
we have a perceptive audience member who notes that the ghost, Jim Angleton, was from Boise. And how has the CIA changed from Angleton's tenure till now?
The CIA I see today that you might not have seen during Angleton's years isn't as important. I think it's a CIA that's much more diverse in terms of color and women. And I think you're seeing many, many, many more perspectives within the CIA. And Angleton was sort of a unique character because he hoarded a lot of information, and he was conspiratorial, and he was incredibly paranoid. The agency people that I know and I deal with, they're not of the Angleton mode, they're not necessarily paranoid. So
speaking of kind of international intrigue, this questioner asks, why has the Trump administration gone along with the other countries to expel Russian diplomats and workers, and are you losing any good sources as a consequence?
Am I losing? No, I don't have any Russian. I don't have anybody on the Russian payroll.
How do we know that's true?
And that's a really good question. How do we know you're true? Well, I'm going to tell you. I wish I had I wish I had a Russian walk-in, from FSB, SVR, GRU, who could, tell me everything they were doing. Why did Trump retaliate?
Yeah, what do you think?
It's hard to say. It's really, the president seems to wake up every day and do something different. And it's hard to know if he's thinking long term about these actions he's going to take. I know Maggie Haberman, our great reporter. She's like the Trump whisperer. Maggie's covered Trump for years. She knows him. She knows his family. Sometimes it's always the last person he talks to, right? And that could be Sean Hannity for that matter. He literally gets his advice from everybody. It seems like the people, also it seems like the people advising him now are the people who are no longer in the administration who have been kicked out. Trump was in a bind here. Not to retaliate against the Russians would have shown real weakness for what they did to that man and that former Russian spy living in Britain. So I think he was really. I don't think he had much of a choice. And there was probably enormous pressure from his European allies, right? Britain really is our closest ally. Our relationship with them in the intelligence world is extraordinary. They are hand in hand. I can just tell you, and the FBI too, we have Five Eyes, right? Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Britain. They actually work in the FBI building in D.C. So, I think Trump was forced to send a message. Look, it's no doubt early on, they had this idea, Flynn, Trump, maybe others around the administration too, that we could work with the Russians. But if you talk to intelligence professionals, we have different aims. We're a democracy. That's not a democracy. Right? What is happening in Russia is not happening in the U.S. And, maybe the administration is coming to this realization. You talk to former agency guys, CIA guys, and bureau guys who worked the target, who worked the Russians. Their position is they simply can't be trusted. There's an old saying, right? There are friendly countries, but no friendly intelligence services.
So while we're on that theme, a couple related questions. What do you think about WikiLeaks, and is it colluding with Russia? And what do you think will happen to Edward Snowden, who is living in Russia, regarding what's happening? So WikiLeaks and Snowden, kind of two separate themes there.
I didn't deal with Julian Assange when I was at the Post. He's done a number of leaks. I've never dealt directly with Julian Assange. I've never been a beneficiary of the direct beneficiary of his information. I think he'd like to see, he thinks of himself as a whistleblower. He thinks of himself as a journalist. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with all of that. And I think the way he does his business and the way we do our business are dramatically, dramatically different. And I think our interests don't necessarily align in terms of journalism. What was the last part?
Snowden. What's going to happen to Snowden?
I don't know what's going to happen to Snowden. You know, I think I've done a lot of reporting on what would have happened to Snowden if he had come back. I think he was going to get a pretty good deal under Obama. I think they were going to charge him with a single felony, and he was going to have to do minimum jail time, a couple of years. And then he would be free, and then he could go out and take the position that he's a whistleblower, right? And he could live off of that reputation. I mean, it's not going to happen now under Trump. And also, he's put his fate in the hands of Putin. Would anybody here put their fate in the hands of Putin? I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't want to be Snowden. I mean, he could wake up every day, and he must wake up and think, well, he could be trade bait, right? Once we have something the Russians really want, they might offer up Snowden. I don't know if he'll do that because it might look bad that he gives up Snowden, who's essentially a walk-in in their country. But we'll have to see. But I think Snowden probably missed an opportunity to get a better deal under Obama. Mm.
Move back to domestic questions. What are the repercussions of Trump's inability to attract a legal staff? I saw an editorial cartoon today that showed President Trump on the phone saying, "Get me Matlock."
If you're the president of the United States, you should be able to. You would think the best lawyers in the country would want to work for you. I mean, if I'm the president of the United States, I mean, I'm not getting TV lawyers. He's facing one of the most formidable legal teams ever assembled. I mean, these really are some of the smartest people in the country, and in terms of the law, and they're killers. I mean, they are killers. They've already shown that. They've shown that they're going to ding you for lying to the FBI, which is 1,001. They've shown they're going to go after that. They've shown they're going to ding you for violating the Foreign Agent Registrations Act, which is rarely, rarely prosecuted. So, it's hard to make sense of what he's actually thinking. I always joke. You know, it's this mistake people make. FBI is not going to want to hear this. Don't ever talk to the FBI. Don't ever talk to the FBI without a lawyer, and certainly don't lie to them.
Legal advice from the New York Times today. Yeah.
So I don't know what Trump's going to do, but he's certainly eager to get in there. The interesting thing is, does Trump? You know, I don't know what people's expectation is for Hillary Clinton. It was like, well, she's got to go. She wants to be president. She's got to go talk. She's got to meet with the FBI so they can finish out this investigation. If she doesn't, then it's going to look like she was withholding something, right? That she was being dishonest. But just, I mean, I'm posing this as a question because I'm certainly not in Trump's head. Does Trump really care? So what? He doesn't meet with the FBI. I don't think his base cares. They don't care. What's up? So what? They've cast this as a witch hunt, right? They've cast this as fake news in a witch hunt. So what's the upside for Trump going in and talking to Mueller's team? I don't know.
So are you predicting that ultimately he won't talk to Mueller?
I mean, he says he wants to.
Right.
But, you know, the lawyers surrounding him were telling him this is not a good idea. I mean, this is not a good idea. You know, you can imagine, I mean, Hillary Clinton, I can't remember how long your interview was. It's like 2.5-3 hours. I mean, Trump could say a lot in 2.5 or 3 hours.
So, well, if he took your advice, he'd just stay in the White House.
I see it time and time again. People are like, FBI shows up. Hey, can we talk to you? Oh, yeah, sure. Bad idea.
So you said something in your opening arguments, and I made a note to myself, too. This interesting relationship between Trump and the New York Times.
Yeah.
And he makes a lot of hay by, you know, you guys are enemies, you're the fake news, you're failing, and yet he seems to love the attention. And that's maybe that's an ungracious way of saying he still talks to your reporters. Is that continue today, or has that pipeline shut down?
I don't know about my reporter's direct interactions with Trump. I mean, obviously, we all know that he has interviewed reporters from the New York Times. I remember Mike Schmidt was down in Mar-a-Lago,
right.
and he positioned himself close to Trump, and he ended up getting an interview with Trump. I mean, Trump knows who Mike Schmidt is, and he did that. And he, you know, obviously he's talked to Maggie Haberman repeatedly and given interviews. I don't know. I think he likes being in the Times. I think he thinks if he's in the Times, he's being treated seriously. And I don't think this is a stretch to say. I think he craves attention, right? I mean, does that seem like a stretch?
That's the headline from today.
And the Times and the Times is a pretty good platform to get attention.
Got it.
It seems like it's an odd relationship. You know, the funny thing is, he must know this. Every time he attacks the Times, it's like our digital subscriptions go up. I mean, you know, I'll say this. I mean, the Times is. People weren't buying it. Just people. What was Obama's nickname? Does anybody remember? No drama, Obama, right? And people weren't clamoring to buy the news. It seemed like the news was a little less essential under Obama. But now for Trump, I mean, the Times subscriptions have soared. It's been astronomical. And you know, in his own way, he's buoyed this important institution. And he must know that.
Interesting. Several questions about kind of journalistic techniques, and here's a straightforward one. How do you get information from the special prosecutor's team? Are they leaking, and should we be worried about that process?
I'm not going to talk about who's telling us what, but...
Just between us.
Yeah, just between us. That's a question. I'm not calling that fake news, but I'm going to talk about that. I get one dodge, that's it.
So it is unusual, is it not, to see the amount of information that we are seeing about what's going on? It's an opaque process.
There's a lot of information in D.C., right? There are a lot of people who know a lot of things. And you just got to figure out where the information, who's got the information. People talk. It's human nature, right? People talk. In fact, people love to talk. And that happens a lot in the swamp, right? People talk.
Describe how you might be pressured to report stories that will sell your publication at the expense of focusing on other events or topics. And maybe this is a related... I'll leave it at that.
I've never felt pressure to report a story to sell subscriptions. From where I sit, if there's pressure on me, it's self-imposed pressure to compete and to get details, whether it's details about the shooting in Las Vegas or what happened in Parkland. It's all self-imposed because I'm incredibly competitive, and I want to get the story. But there can't be pressure to sell newspapers because that's when you go off the rails. That's when you start getting stuff wrong. And when that happens repeatedly and often enough, I think you lose the trust of the people reading your paper.
Especially in a place like Idaho.
Yeah.
People appreciate good things that is happening in the Trump administration on the economy, yeah, on ISIS, and other things. And those get overshadowed by sensational news.
Yeah, but I think that's partly Trump's fault. But I would say the Times, and the Times has answered this publicly, and you can read about it. I mean, I think the Times has covered his successes, Trump's successes, in depth too. Speeding up the war on ISIS, right? Destroying the so-called caliphate in Syria. Look, the stock market's up. You can say, well, that's just a product of Obama, right, and repeated, growth periods. But, Trump owns that, right? It's up under his watch. I think there are other successes he's had that we've written about, Maybe not everybody agrees, but I think a lot of people in this country saw that, what happened with bump stocks, right? Essentially turning the semi-automatic weapons and the automatic weapons, we saw what happened with that, right? a lot of people were died in Las Vegas. So he did take actions there. Maybe they weren't what everybody wanted, or at least, you know, the Democrats wanted. But, you know, let's be fair to Trump. He has had his successes. I think some of these successes are overshadowed by the chaos in the White House. Trump said the other day publicly he loves conflict. I mean, he fired his Secretary of State on Twitter. Matt, can you imagine that? Has anybody fired any of your employees on Twitter? What do you think that would do if you fired one of your employees on Twitter? Like, these are partly self-inflicted wounds, but he seems to enjoy them.
All right, speaking of firing via Twitter, I still don't understand, given as much.
Oh, I want to make a point about that, too. Not only did Trump fire his Secretary of State, I mean, this guy was CEO of one of the biggest companies in the world, right? Guy comes out to work for this administration, to be a patriot, and he gets fired via Twitter. And did you read where he was when he got fired? He was on the crapper. And John Kelly, Trump's chief of staff, told reporters that. Why would you humiliate? What is the need to humiliate? What was the need to humiliate Rex Tillerson? Nobody has explained that to me, right? He served his country, he did it for a year, and he was fired on the crapper, and the White House let everybody know about it.
So,
yeah.
Why does Donald Trump keep Jeff Sessions, and why does Jeff Sessions stay with Donald Trump?
Okay, well, I have a couple of thoughts on Jeff Sessions. First of all, people can dislike Jeff Sessions. That's obviously a right. But when push came to shove, I just make this point about Jeff Sessions. He recused himself from the Russia investigation, and Trump clearly dislikes him for doing that because that was the right thing to do, right? By him recusing himself from the Russia investigation, that ensures that Mueller's team survives. Jeff Sessions put Donald Trump in an incredible corner, okay? The Senate has told Donald Trump, you don't get to fire one of our own. Jeff Sessions was a longtime senator. Senators, you don't get to mistreat one of our own. So they've told, Trump knows this, that if he fires Sessions, I don't know if Chuck Grassley, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, would let a nomination go through. So that would leave Trump essentially without a confirmed AG. There's a problem here, and it's clearly the two don't. It seems like Sessions is doing everything he can to carry out Trump's agenda, I'm not sure. It's not clear to me whether Trump, you know, actually appreciates that. I mean, Sessions is a pretty loyal foot soldier to Trump. But he has humiliated him repeatedly. I mean, it's a little mystifying why Sessions continues to want to be in that job. Well, you're also humiliated by the president on Twitter. It's like they're glutton for punishments. But, you know, Sessions is also carrying out his agenda, and he believes this agenda is right. And Trump was, you know, elected in part to carry out this agenda. So I do have a theory. I do think once this investigation ends, Sessions might not be around that long. So
if you're Jeff Sessions, you may be nervous every time you go to the bathroom.
And anybody in this cabinet can be nervous now when you go to the bathroom.
So for our radio audience, I just want to note that this is a Boise City Club forum with New York Times reporter Adam Goldmans. So here's for Trump supporters or flyover state Republicans, the New York Times is an elitist organization not to be trusted, regardless of what the president says. So do the New York Times folks ever discuss this marketing challenge that you are kind of seen as
it's true. I mean, it's... You know, the digital subscription to the Times isn't cheap. And, you know, I've heard this. People say, like, well, why? It's a sort of a luxury brand, right? And why would you pay for this when you could get news for free, on your your Twitter feed or Facebook? To be frank, you know, I didn't go to an Ivy League school, right? I just went to a public, state college, University of Maryland. and I worked my way up through the ranks, right? I paid my dues to be at the New York Times. And I worked in Alabama. I worked in Virginia. I worked in Las Vegas, right? And you know, I don't see myself as an elitist. I think what I've experienced in working with Times reporters is the authority they write with and our knowledge about the subjects. And that's what, you know, when you're reading a story about the FBI and I'm writing about it, you know, hopefully that comes through that, you know what, Adam Goldman really knows this institution. And I'll give another example. When Trump said he was going to nominate his deputy director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, to be the director of the CIA, a lot of people wrote stories that she was running this overseas prison in Thailand in 2002. It was part of the Bush era, you know, rendition interrogation detention program. And people said she was in charge of this secret base where this guy was waterboarded repeatedly. And everybody wrote that, except me. So I wrote the story. She wasn't there for that. And I know that because I've deeply reported this subject. And the Times was able to write a story that was fair to Gina Haspel, right? And fair to the CIA that she, in fact, was not at that base for when that particular detainee was there. And I know that because I've reported on the subject for years and years and years. And I still continue to report on that. And, you know, in the end, another media outlet had to do a big, ugly correction. I mean, it was really ugly. And I felt bad for them because I don't like to revel in other people's misery because, you know, by the grace of God we go, right? So that's what I try to say. That's what you're paying for. You're paying for expertise. You might not like the Times opinion pages. Fine. I don't read our opinion pages. I mean, I know. I say that honestly. Like, I'm so busy trying to ferret out information. You know, what they're saying and what they're projecting isn't really a concern to me. And I really, you know, it's really, really important. It is really important. People don't want to hear this, whether the far left, too. I mean, I remember last year, Mattapuzzo and I went down to Duke. And, you know, it was like far left screeching at the New York Times. Oh, you guys, you know, you should have reported this Russia stuff earlier. You're the reason Trump's president. No, we're not the reason Trump's president. And you know, so we face this on both sides, and from the far left and from the right, which is fine.
So the short answer was, you guys recognize that some people think you're elitist, and you try to address it.
Look, there's no doubt the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other big journalism institutions have got to do a far better job at midterms, right, in 2018. I mean, everybody was predicting Hillary would win this thing, right? I mean, there have been stories written, even Trump didn't, right? Even Trump thought he was going to lose this. But we've got to do the New York Times clearly has to do a better job in understanding, you know, the mindset between California and New York, right? And I think we can all agree on that.
So as a reporter, how do you assess the contents of Michael Wolff's book? And secondarily, another insider White House question. What's the view of Sarah Huckabee Sanders by White House reporters?
Well, I'm not a White House reporter, and I haven't read Michael Wolff's book. You know, I've heard various interpretations of it. There's some truth in it. I think he's backed off some things he had written. I think Michael Wolff achieved what he wanted to do was they let the fox in the hen house, right? And he wrote a book, and he made a lot of money. I can't talk about the veracity in the book. I'm not a White House reporter, so I don't really deal with the White House. I think Sarah Huckabee has done a better job than Sean Spicer. Sean, I mean, that was the wrong tack to take. She's controlled. She talks, you know, she speaks with a straight face. That was a compliment.
So this questioner notes that CNN documentary on the Kennedys portrayed John and or Robert as a backdoor connection to the Kremlin and Khrushchev. And so How are the connections between past presidents and Democratic presidents different than the connections we see today? Why is it such a big deal today?
I mean, I'm not an expert on past presidents, though. What we've seen today are Russian intelligence attempts to gain access to sort of mid-level players, right? From, you know, from Carter Page to George Papadopoulos. I mean, essentially what was happening in July of 16 is once the FBI was done with the Hillary email investigation, there was all this smoke, right? You know, you had Flynn, you had Manafort, you had Carter Page, you had Papadopoulos. There were these unexplained associations and connections. I mean, you know, the FBI was thinking to itself in July, well, you know, why is Michael Flynn, a three-star general, who is in possession of some of these our country's most valuable secrets, right, going to a dinner in Moscow for RT? RT is a propaganda arm of Putin. They disseminate propaganda. They've now been listed as a foreign agent, okay? Why is he going and sitting there with Putin? I mean, everybody knows what Putin's about, right? And he's going and sitting there. So there are all these, this isn't a state dinner either. And by the way, it turned out that Michael Flynn took more than $67,000 in Russian money. And we only know that because Congress released the documents. But he failed to acknowledge that. And he failed to acknowledge that on his security forms, what's called the FS-86. Apparently he failed to acknowledge that when he was re-interviewed for a security clearance. So there was a lot of smoke there, different than what we see. This isn't like, and the funny thing about it is like, I don't understand why all these Trump people felt the need to arrange some dinner with Putin. I mean, to arrange a dinner with Putin for Trump. All Trump has to do is pick up the phone. I mean, literally all the guy has to do is pick up the phone or have his, you know, the Secretary of State or his ambassador. I mean, it just created a lot of smoke. And it's still sort of confusing to me today.
This questioner actually gives us stage directions. He says, time to pivot.
Yeah.
Welcome, David. I'm concerned about terrorism, and in my opinion, we absolutely need a wall not between us and Mexico, but a firewall to protect our information, our intellectual property, our infrastructure, our electrical grid. Is there any movement among journalists to direct attention towards that danger posed by cyber attack?
I mean, clearly, whoever asked this question, it's a great question, because you know, if you look at instances of actual terrorism being committed in this country, it's fairly small. I'm not saying the risk is not there, and the FBI certainly devotes a ton of resources. But God knows, the cyber espionage threat is extraordinary. And China, Russia, Iran, I mean, they are trying to steal all of our secrets, all of them. And it is very alarming. And journalists, you know, we didn't. I think initially, when we started to see this cyber threat years and years ago, I'm not sure journalists necessarily were eager to tackle this subject. But now it's one that's become very important to these papers, and these hacks that have been committed by China and Russia are extraordinary. And you know, it comes down to a personal level too. I mean, I hope everybody in this room should be very careful about, you know, using your, you know, from the most basic level, you know, not using your debit card at a restaurant, right? You use your Visa with a chip at the restaurant, right? I mean, on every single letter, because these are all cyber crimes, right? Whether they're being done by mobsters in Russia who are stealing your credit card information, or say somebody here works for the government. Say somebody here has a security clearance. Imagine your information's on LinkedIn. You know, Russians be like, oh, that's an interesting guy. He's on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a great place to find people. I know. I do it. I'm on it every day, right? You know, how are you protecting your information? No, it's only going to get worse. I mean, these stories about cyber theft, cyber espionage, and the damage they're doing to our country are only going to grow. And one of the great examples is the Chinese military. I mean, they've effectively. I mean, I think technologically, their military capability is only something like, and I'm not stating this as fact, I think I just read this the other day, if I recall it correctly. I mean, they're literally only 10 years behind us. And mainly that's because they've been stealing all our secrets. And though the flip side of that is you say, well, what should we should respond? We should respond. We should respond. But remember, we're doing the same thing, right? Our government's out there stealing everybody else's secrets, right? They're stealing Russia's secrets. They're stealing China's secrets. So, you know, if there's going to be a firewall, I would suggest you build the firewall around yourself. And you make sure your emails are encrypted. You know what? If you want to send text messages, use Signal. Use WhatsApp, right? Use Facebook, right? Well, maybe not Facebook. but anyway.
So now you're making us paranoid.
Yeah.
With all the spying, Russia, et cetera, do you or your colleagues ever feel afraid or threatened yourselves?
I know for my colleagues who work overseas, it's a very difficult operating environment. And the idea that if you work in Moscow or you work in Beijing and those governments don't know exactly what you're doing, they know exactly what you're doing. And I'm not sure of all the security precautions they take working over there, but I'm sure they take many. I use many myself. I can imagine the Russians would like to get into my emails, right? So essentially what I've done is I've essentially stopped emailing. I mean, basic bureaucratic stuff with editors, hey, you need to do the story. But any information I might possess, right, I don't put it in an email. Never. I mean, I figure my expectation is whatever I put in an email is one day going to be hacked and made public. That's my expectation. So, you know, we are using encrypted devices, right, to protect our information. And we're not putting it in an email. And, it's sad that it's come to that, but that's where we are today. My great fear is not being targeted by the Russians. My great fear is I'm going to be targeted by the U.S. government. That government who has extraordinary powers, right? I mean, the government can see, you know, let me step back on Snowden. There was a lot of conversation at the time when Snowden released what was then called metadata. Right, the government was collecting your calls, right? And if they needed the search for a terrorist, or they needed to get it for whatever reason, they needed to get it in this database, they would go into it, and people would say, "Wow, it's just my metadata. So what? They just know my phone numbers or who I'm calling. Big deal. You know what I can get just from your metadata, from your phone numbers? I can figure out your daily routine. I can figure out when you're leaving your house." When you're going, you know, people you're calling, who you're having an affair with. Now, why are you calling that number once a month, twice a month, right? I mean, there's an extraordinary amount of information you can get from that. So, and that represents some of the government's powers, and those powers are extraordinary. And when you wake up and you realize your phone numbers have been subpoenaed by the government, right, and they know everybody you've talked to for 90 days, right, or they can get an email for they can get a subpoena or a warrant for your emails. I mean, under the Obama administration, and Obama, you know, his crackdown. People have this rosy view of Obama when it comes to journalists. Obama led the hardest crackdown on journalists of any president ever. He went after our sources and he put them in prison. Obama hated leaks. Maybe Obama hated leaks more than Trump hated leaks, okay? And he labeled Obama's Justice Department to get a reporter's emails labeled him a co-conspirator. The journalist was just doing his job, and that Justice Department granted approval to get a warrant to label a journalist a co-conspirator in a crime. And, you know, once all this started coming out, the Obama administration retreated. Now, most people know this. Now the Justice Department has something called media guidelines. And so these guidelines are put in place to protect journalists. There's no federal shield law in the end. The federal government could force me to testify at a trial. But you have something called media guidelines, and these media guidelines are supposed to protect us. Jeff Sessions, his Justice Department, is talking actively right now how they're going to water them down. One of the things this Justice Department would like to do, I don't know if they've done it or they're going to do it. Previously, if the Justice Department wanted to subpoena our record, they had to exhaust all interviews. So in my case, the FBI interviewed more than 500 people. and eventually determined they couldn't figure out who my source was. And then they got the subpoena. What the Justice Department, it's my understanding, what they would like to do and what the FBI would like to do now is get rid of those exhaustion guidelines. So the day I publish, imagine what would happen the day I publish a story that had classified information, they could go to a judge or a grand jury and get a subpoena and get my phone records, emails. And they could start doing that to journalists all over the country. And then where would your flow of information be? Then what would you know about what your government is doing? I like to say this. Stop thinking about this in terms of right or left, about Obama, about Trump, about Republicans or Democrats. This is about knowing what your government is doing, using your money and what they're doing. And if that flow of information is somehow constrained or constricted or destroyed, you're not going to know anything about what your government's doing. And that should scare everybody. You want to know what your government is doing. It's not about being a Democrat or Republican.
This has been Adam Goldman, New York Times reporter, Boise City Club Forum. Really insightful and informative. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is on Wednesday, April 18th, and features Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Jack Oman discussing uncommon ground, drawing the purple line between red and blue. Learn more at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.